Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. This week in music history is going to be a fun event. And along with me for this ride through history is my friend, Jacob Crum.
Good evening.
And I don't have Greg Harvey with me, but that's fine. Greg's out doing what he's doing, and wish him the best wherever he is. But I got to say, if you like the show, and hopefully you do, because you're listening so far all of 30 seconds in, if you want to help us out, go to our website. You can click on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side. It takes you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping. It doesn't cost you a thing, and we get a little bit of money back. It is that simple. Or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Now, this week in music history, we got a lot of good events coming up, a lot of funny ones that I liked. Jake picked out his. I picked out mine. Surprisingly, we didn't have any crossover, actually, when we picked these out.
Zero, none, zilch,
so,
nada.
We didn't pick the same event, which, you know, usually we've got a little bit of crossover, but that's because I try to find things that I think, oh, Jake might like this or Greg might like this, you know, so I try to do that. But we're also trying to cut down a little bit on the size of our podcast, you know, because we get into that hour and a half range. It's like, we can do better. We can hit an hour. That should be doable. So, but let's get on. We are starting with April 24th, going through April 28th this week. And I got to say, starting off with this one for April 24th, not music related at all. All right? But we got going back in
1915 is
the commemoration date of the Armenian Genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may be asking yourself, Brian, I wanted music history, not regular history. Well, all right, so this one is a little bit more personal to me because I know some Armenians. I have a few friends that are Armenian musicians and, you know, people who are currently in Armenia, actually. It's kind of amazing. And I am also the producer for the show Armenia Proud at lineupmedia.fm. So I get to be there and interview some really great people, really great prominent Armenians in the community. And this is like a huge day for them. And I just wanted to sort of, you know, not necessarily stand in solidarity, but to, you know, extend, you know, a point of reference to being like, you know what, I am going to remember this day with you because more people need to know about this. But yeah, in 1915, that was what they considered to be the start of the Armenian Genocide. 1.5 million Armenians were killed, and this was all happening during World War I, and so, like, nobody knows about it. So now you do. If you get a chance, go check out the movie The Promise that just came out this last week. It's amazing. We interviewed the producer on Armenia Proud, and it was a fascinating conversation, but all in all, really, really great stuff. And it's an excellent movie starring Christian Bale. And I know this is so bad. I'm totally getting my nerd thing. But the dude from the episode 7, the X-Wing pilot who played Poe. So I don't remember his name. I've forgotten.
So if anyone out there was asking the question, can Brian Kroc nerd out on the Armenian Genocide? The answer is yes.
X-Wing pilot and Batman in the same movie, okay, playing Armenians, or I think one of them's playing actually an American and the other one's playing an Armenian. But either way, Armenians, we remember this day with you because it's what we do. We Odars, you know, are that way. An Odar is a person who's non-Armenian, if you didn't know that. So there you go.
Holy mountains.
Moving on to 1944. Jake, what you got?
1944.
Yes.
Yes, 1944. On this day in history, Ivor Novello was convicted of conspiracy to misuse petrol coupons.
Wait, who?
Okay, so Ivor Novello, it was a Welsh composer, and was kind of the rock star of his day. We're talking like pre-World War II, early, like the Roaring Twenties.
Yeah.
In England.
Yeah.
And the United Kingdom was all Ivor.
Okay.
He's a real character, dressed flashy, flamboyantly, liked to drive fast cars.
Mm.
And during World War II, there was a ration for gasoline, or as they call it, petrol. And he didn't like that very much. And apparently, he had a habit of getting fans of his, or his groupies, to give them his petrol coupons so that he could just jet set around wherever he wanted to go. And it landed him with an 8-day jail sentence, of which he served 4 days for.
Wow.
So there you
Eight days in prison for using too much gas.
8 days in prison.
Not quite as much of a catchy song, but
for driving. I don't know.
So what else you got? I know you had a couple here.
Yeah, here we
going
go.
Going back.
We also got 1961, the very first professional recording of Bob Dylan.
Oh, nice.
Yes. He played harmonica on Calypso King for Harry Belafonte.
Yes.
And was paid $50.
Yes.
Which is actually, that was a decent amount of money for a session musician in 1961.
That was an incredible amount of money.
So Harry Belafonte taking care of your boys, good on you.
Yeah.
And let's move on up to 1968. This is a little bit of a, I couldn't exactly pin down the date on it, so I'm just going to say April 24th.
Sure.
But at some point, AppleCorp, the Beatles music label, passed on David Bowie.
Yes. I heard about that. Yes. They signed a bunch of other people, but yeah, they completely skipped out on Bowie, which is kind of funny. I wonder what would have happened had he been able to team up with Apple like that.
I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing at some point Ringo would have been on an album.
I honestly think that it would have been worse for his career.
I've heard a lot of people say that, and I don't know why.
Because I think that he was given a lot more creative free reign later on. So that's how he could do things like Ziggy Stardust and, you know, like sort of completely recreate himself whenever he wanted to.
Yeah, but like from everything that I've read about AppleCorp, it was just kind of a willy-nilly just mix of whatever kind of flew. Like whatever stuck to the wall is what happened. It wasn't exactly like overlords coming down like, we're the music geniuses of the Beatles and you should definitely dye your hair blonde. That's how we'll make money.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. I don't know. It is what it is. Could have happened.
Right.
But it didn't. So.
Right. And the only source we have for it is a Bowie biographies. So there's nothing, like there's not a letter coming from AppleCorp where they're denying him, you know, so.
Yeah. But let's see. Speaking of the Beatles, moving on to 1976, one of my favorite weird little factoids that I've known for a long time. 1976, Paul and Linda McCartney spent the evening with John Lennon at his New York, Dakota apartment and watched Saturday Night Live on TV.
Yes.
The producer of the show, Lorne Michaels, made an offer on air asking the Beatles to turn up and play three songs live. Lennon and McCartney thought about taking a cab to the studio, but decided they were too tired. This was the last time that Paul and John were together.
So, let that be a lesson to everyone. Never be too tired to do anything.
it's kind of an incredible thing in and of itself, just because like I know that before that somebody offered them like $1 million to get back together.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like and Lorne Michaels offered them like $1,000 or something.
It was $3,000.
$3,000.
Yeah, which was apparently like
you could split however which
right,
way
right.
You want.
Apparently that's like union scale in New York during the 70s.
Wow.
It was $3,000, so.
That is fascinating, though, either way. I've heard that story 100 times from my father, and it still cracks me up to this day that they considered it, that they actually thought, eh, maybe let's go do that. And then they didn't. Like, eh, well, whatever. Moving on up to 1979, Ray Charles's Georgia On My Mind was proclaimed the state song of Georgia. The music of the song was written in 1930 by Hoagy Carmichael. I'm not kidding, that is his name.
Hoagy Carmichael. What else has he written?
I don't know.
Okay.
Who also recorded a version of the song in New York in the same year. Ray Charles, though, a native of Georgia, recorded it in 1960 on his album The Genius Hits the Road. That's some marketing thing right there. The genius hits the road.
Oh, okay.
And let's see. Closing out April 24th, born on this day in 1982, we have Kelly Clarkson, who, of course, won the very first American Idol.
Yes.
I predicted her win very early on.
Well, congratulations.
I bat extremely well when it came to American Idol, like picking the winners. Towards the end there, it got just too stupid easy because basically it was whatever white guy with a guitar showed up. So, but yeah, is what it is.
Yeah.
But Kelly Clarkson, she was, you know, the first winner of American Idol and still my favorite American Idol just because I thought she gave some great pop songs and wrote some good stuff and just won a bunch of Grammys and stuff too. So she's nice. I like her. Let's move on. See, we're already flying through days faster than we normally do. April 25th, got another birthday for you here, Jake. 1918, right. Born on this day, Ella Fitzgerald.
Ah, there we go, yeah.
Now, she is a queen in the music world. I mean, she did so many great songs. I mean, like, just Mac the Knife alone should place her in that, you know, category. But she basically influenced every female singer that came after her. And she died June 15th, 1996, you know, but it's amazing to see just the sheer level of impact that Ella Fitzgerald had on the music world. And if you get a chance, there's a couple of different movies that have her depicted in there. Go check them out, because you get a real sort of idea for how amazing she was. So, and I mean, there's books about her too. So there you go. But Jake, you got something for me?
I do. 1955, the UN's Commission on Narcotics wrote a report, and in that report they said that a, quote, definite connection between the increased marijuana smoking and that form of entertainment known as bebop.
Okay.
So, all right. So the U.S. government in the 1950s was not the only group who was trying to get some kind of control over what was becoming pop.
Yeah.
Right. The U.N. apparently was doing it as well. And I went to the U.N.'s website and read through their 1955 narcotics resolutions.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find exactly where this quote came from.
Okay.
However, it's definitely in the spirit of everything that I read from their website.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, in 1955, they basically started to call for everyone who was part of the UN to put up some kind of controlled substance laws in their country. And name opioids and marijuana.
Yeah, it's when they criminalized marijuana. Yeah, I remember that. Not that I was there, but I mean, I remember reading about it. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating because they did the same. I mean, they did some stuff later on too, and it was basically all about the hippies. You know, let's ban all of this stuff because of the hippies. But the control on pop music has always been a fascinating thing.
Like
rock and roll was banned in the UK for a long time, and the only reason why it was ever played. I mean, in the years where you had the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and these massive powerhouses of rock music, like they just banned rock music outright on the radio.
Yeah.
And so that's why pirate radio stations had to set up off the coast, and they even tried to get those things shut down too, mm-hmm. even though they were in international waters. It's like, yeah.
Yeah,
another great movie that came from that, though, was Pirate Radio, which was a brilliant radio movie, actually.
You know, banning rock and roll in your own country and then trying to prevent the airwaves from being piped into your country is one thing. But you really have to be a gigantic blowhard to try and take your own citizens as an example to the UN to get other countries to pass the same laws you have.
See, now here's the funny thing is that had they really tried to do that in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I know they did a little bit, but had they really tried to do that, like everybody would have just gone down south to Mexico where they had like these 500,000 watt like AM stations that could literally kill birds if they flew next to the towers.
Yeah.
And they just blast music out to all of America. It's kind of insane, actually, what they did back in the day. They're just like, let's just make a stupid, powerful radio antenna and just blast music to everybody, whether they want it or not.
Why not?
Why not? But let's see here. You got more for me?
Oh, I guess I do. All right. So 1974.
Yes.
The Rolling Stones reports on a new fad called streaking that happened, and their examples were a Yes and a Greg Allman concert. And in that same year, later that same year, Penthouse published a article and put on the title of the article on their cover that's still quoted, I hear quoted to this day, "The Wonderful World of Streaking."
come on, everybody, we're going to the quad, going streaking. Is that literally what they were talking about, was getting naked and running?
Yeah. That was...
See, I didn't know if that was like slang for something else.
No, that was the fad in 1974. Like,
that seems like a weird fad to have.
No, Brian, listen, all right, I worked with a lot of just blue-collar people that were young in 1974, and I swear to you, once a week I heard somebody say, why don't teenagers streak anymore? Why don't young people get naked and run through concerts? I don't understand.
I'll tell you why. It's because of this little thing right here.
The cell phones
with the cameras and everything. Everybody gets pictures of everything now.
But there should have been a learning curve. But there wasn't. Streaking is just, it was gone.
This sounds like something that was invented by Jim Morrison, though. So
maybe. I don't know.
You know, he was like, come on, everybody, we're going streaking.
Not really. No, because I don't think he wanted other people to join in. I think he wanted everyone to bask in the glory that was that was his naked frame.
There you go. Moving on up to 1987, U2 started a 5-week run at number one on the U.S. charts with their fifth studio album, The Joshua Tree. Inspired by their American tour experiences with literature and politics, the album topped the charts in 20 different countries and is still one of the all-time best-selling albums with over 25 million copies sold. The album also won Grammy Award for Album of the Year and produced the hit singles With or Without You, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, and Where the Streets Have No Name. Yep.
I don't have anything good to say about that.
You're just a diehard U2 fan. I know it, Jake.
Yeah.
No, for me, though, like the Joshua Tree album, like it, I don't know. It's got a special place in my heart because I consider it to be the best U2 album out there, like that they ever did. And I know my wife would argue with me about it, but you know, for me though, like the Joshua Tree album kind of set the standard for like all Christian music to come.
Yeah.
So,
which is just another reason for me to dislike it,
which is really kind of bad. I mean, I know somebody from my church is probably bound to listen to this episode, so I'm going to say it anyway, but we started doing this song at church, and the song is the chord progression for With or Without You.
Yeah.
And it's the same chord progression.
Yeah.
And so when we're playing, it's slower than With or Without You. But when we started playing it, everybody was singing the lines and stuff like that. And I just started, like, while I'm playing drums, mind you, in my little cage, just started screaming as loud as I could, you know, I can't live with or without you. and then when we finished, everybody was like, you know, when we were practicing, everybody was like, you know, so what do you think of the song? And I said, well, I don't know this U2 song. I've never heard it before. And they all looked at me.
What?
Like, what are you talking about? But, you know. That's my own weird humor. Yeah. So,
but you know, contemporary Christian music has a long history of trying to force artists to emulate other popular artists.
Yeah, unfortunately, Christian artists tended to then emulate U2 and nothing but U2.
Well, yeah, for like a good decade. But right now, who's the guy that does that? The River Song.
Oh, you might be going back.
No. This came out like last year. Current pop guy, hold back the river, let me look at your eyes.
James Bay,
right? That hat that he wears, I've seen like three guys that wear that hat on a cover.
Yeah, that's a hipster kind of hat now.
Yeah,
so.
But in a Christian music, like in a Christian bookstore.
Yeah,
right. There were three different people on covers dressed just like James Bay, and did it make me cringe.
Yeah, like, I can spot when certain things happen. I know this is the weirdest tangent that we've gone on so far, but I can spot when something enters into pop culture where it then goes in Christian music.
Yeah.
Because I said the exact same thing about Explosions in the Sky. Like the second I heard Explosions in the Sky on the Friday Night Lights soundtrack, I was like, this is going to get emulated in Christian music. And I was right. Hillsongs United, like the following year, came out with an album, and every single one of them had that sort of guitar riff thing that Explosions in the Sky does with U2 chord progressions. Oh. And I was like, oh my goodness, this needs to stop. But it is what it is. I mean, they're going to do what they do. They write pop songs that are Christian themed, and everybody wants to... play them in their own churches and do all that. I'm kind of tired of it. So, but that's just me. Sorry, guys, is what it is. I'm bored with Christian music these days.
Agreed.
I am hypercritical of it. I do like my dad's band, though, Mercy's Child. That band rocks hard. I love it. And at least they write all their own stuff. Let's see. Oh, man. Moving on to 1990, the Fender Stratocaster that Jimi Hendrix played at Woodstock was auctioned for a record-selling $295,000. His two-hour set at the 1969 festival became the longest of his career.
Mm.
Which is amazing, because when you watch the Woodstock documentary, like the movie, they, like, you see him playing, and he's playing to, like, the smallest crowd, like, of the entire festival. And that's because he played last. So, there's Jimi Hendrix. Of course he played for 2 hours, because he was playing to, like, a couple hundred people.
Right.
Like, as opposed to the thousands that could go to see him, like, at the Monterey Pop Festival, but... And then, Jake, I think you're actually closing out this day.
Oh, here we go. 1992. One of my favorite
anything that makes you laugh
90s.
Before you even say it has got to be pretty good. So,
oh boy, Jump by Criss Cross hit number one.
Jump, jump.
Mac Daddy make you wanna.
Jump, jump.
The Daddy Mac will make you wanna.
Jump, jump.
How high? Dude, like... Two, like, what, 14-year-olds just, like, storm the pop charts, have one album, have a follow-up, and then kind of, like, disappear into the more esoteric charts.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure one of those guys is dead now.
He is. Drug overdose. Pretty
sad. Yeah. I mean, like, I honestly wonder what happened with their career, because I know, I mean, they had that huge hit, and then they kind of, like, didn't really show up again. But... Was it a like a label thing? Was it just that they I know they made more music.
Yeah, but... they did. They had like six albums, I think.
So.
And, well, the shtick of being 14-year-olds to wear their clothes backwards wore off pretty quick.
Yeah. You know? But.
And.
The wiggity wiggity wiggity. I can't even do it.
Right. But their music got more sophisticated and was actually kind of interesting. Not that long ago, I went and kind of listened through it.
Because
I found an article on them. And then, after the 2000s, they just kind of, like, quit doing music. One guy, I think the guy who's still around was a music producer. And then the dude that OD'd, Chris, I can't remember either of their last names now. The Mac Daddy, not the Daddy Mac. he became an artist.
Yeah.
And did some graffiti artists, but a lot of like oil on canvas stuff too.
Nice.
So he carved out a little niche for himself there.
Yeah.
Good work too from stuff I've seen.
Cool.
And I think his family now, actually, they operate a website for him, and you can get like t-shirts with some of his art and stuff put on it,
cool.
Which is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, that's good. At least they did something good out of the, you know, the tragedy of losing him. So
yeah. Another weird kind of little fact off of this story, the guy that produced their first album, Jermaine Dupri, also produced the first album for Lil Bow Wow.
Wow. I don't care.
Really?
I don't care about Lil Bow Wow.
I just appreciate that there's a producer out there that specializes in like tween rap albums. That's what he does. But let's close out the day in 1994 with Michael Bolton. And plagiarism. And this day, 1994, a jury ruled that Michael Bolton plagiarized Love is a Wonderful Thing by the Isley Brothers, and he was ordered to pay a sum of $5.4 million, the largest sum in a plagiarism suit in U.S. history.
Wow.
And that was 23 years ago.
Crazy.
So either people have stopped caring about, or the Isley Brothers just had a really good case against the guy.
I guess so. Man, it's kind of all up in the air when it comes to that stuff, but you'll never know. So that's it for April 25th. Let's move on to April 26th. In 1966, Dusty Springfield goes to number one in the UK singles charts with You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is actually one of my favorite songs from her. I mean, not that I've like know a ton of her songs, but I know a few of her songs. But that one right there, because it's just, you don't have to say you love me, just be close at hand. Like, it's just a great melody.
Yeah.
And she sings it exceptionally well. Well, the reason why she sings it exceptionally well was because when recording the track, Springfield was not satisfied with her vocal takes until she recorded 47 takes.
47.
I don't know about you, but I can't sing 47 takes. I can do like one song like maybe five times in a row before I'm just like, nope, I'm done with this. I can't sing it any differently.
I mean, I could do like 47 takes of like the Bunny Bread song or...
Well, yeah, like a jingle, obviously. Right.
Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. No, not doing it. Let's do it again.
The touch, the feel of cotton, the fabric of our lives. Written by Richie Havens, actually. Yeah. One of my favorite artists and favorite weird factoid about Richie Havens.
All right, yeah. Put that one in your pocket and take it to the bank.
So let's see, moving on up to 1969. During the band's second North American tour, Led Zeppelin played the second of two nights at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco. And it was during that show that they played Whole Lot of Love for the first time.
The first time, huh?
Yeah. Live for the first time.
Meow.
That's a great little riff that he does. It's so simple.
Yes.
And yet so perfect. If you've seen the documentary, It Might Get Loud, which follows, you know, three different guitar players, follows Jimmy Page, The Edge, and Jack White from the White Stripes, or a bunch of other stuff too. I mean, Rackin' Tours and then now solo stuff. And it was sort of all done by Jack White. Like, and he got the other two guys together. And Jimmy Page, like, explains how he came up with that riff and stuff, and he plays it, and it's just so easy and ridiculous. It's like, oh my goodness, like, this man is an absolute genius. And that's because he kind of is. So, but great documentary if you want to see sort of three different guitarists in how they came up and how they play. Very, very different styles completely. And it gave me a new respect for Jack White, because I always just thought, oh, this dude, you know, like, oh, he wrote that one song that's got that one riff that he just repeats over and over again. Gave me a whole new level of respect for him, and a whole other level of respect for Jimmy Page. The Edge, I was like, okay, I expected this from you. So,
man, Jack
White. Sorry, Edge, but a lot of your stuff is effects, man. It's like, it's not like real skill there.
Jack White is like a music historian. That guy has appreciation for everything.
Yeah. I mean, he honestly is probably one of the best amongst us in our generation.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of the same way that Springsteen was for his, you know, because Springsteen is an absolute music historian. Jack White is the same way, except he's a little bit more current. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's great. Great, great guy. Moving on to 1977, what you got?
Oh, here we go. We got two things on the same day in 1977.
What? Two for one?
We've got Studio 54 opens.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say anything that hasn't already been
that
said.
That wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That place is so infamous.
Right. You know, what killed me is when I was looking this up, I was like, all right, when did it open? Well, when did it close? It closed in 1980. It was only open for 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they tried to do like a revival of it at some point. But yeah, I mean, well, once disco was pretty much dead, it was, you know.
I guess. And also, the venue was like torn down and another building was put up.
Oh.
So it's kind of hard to. It was Studio 54 on 54th Street, and I think the address was 254.
Mm.
So, like, it's kind of hard. What are you going to... We're on 73rd Street, which is Studio 73. Our address says none of the numbers in it.
I'm not seeing that it was open for 3 years. I just looked it up. It was open from 1977 to 86.
86?
Yeah. So that's 9 years.
Okay. Well, then it's not nearly as incredible story as I had initially.
Well, it's still pretty incredible. I mean, I'm surprised it lasted that long. Oh, that's funny, because apparently there used to be a Studio 52.
Oh, okay. Well.
Oh, okay. Here we go. All right. So apparently there was the first era of Studio 54, and then there was like a revival of it, and you know, where they sort of built another one.
Yes.
And then like kept going, and apparently like there's still sort of a version of it, that's been going on ever since.
Is it like in like Holland or something?
No, it's in in the U.S.
New York. Okay.
Yeah. Weird. So there you go.
Studio has-beens. All right. Well, also on this day in 1977, the play Neverland opens in Washington, D.C. What's so special about that? Well, all the music and the play itself was written by Jim Steinman, and three of the songs from Neverland are on Bat Out of Hell.
Oh, wow.
Which was recorded like 5 or 6 months after the show opened.
Wow. Yeah, no, I mean, anything that Steinman really did is musically brilliant.
Yeah.
And, I mean, not just the work that he did with Meatloaf, but, I mean, pretty much anything that he did. And he's straight out of that New York theater group.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's that kind of a composer, which is why Bat Out of Hell is a rock opera.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's... Dude was just insanely talented. I mean... just with everything that he touched. So I don't really have anything else to say about that other than I love Bat Out of Hell. So
Jim Steinman. Kudos and
a brilliant album.
Magustilations.
I love that album. It's so good. But right. Was that it for you?
That's all we got for the 26. What do you
No, I got one more for the 26.
Holy cow.
1990. Nirvana appeared at the Pyramid Club in New York City. The band's label Sub Pop filmed the entire show. And the performance of In Bloom was later used as a promo clip.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So there you go. That's all I got. I don't know why I put that one down other than I was like, I want one more. Why not? So I always like talking about Nirvana. It's fun. But let's see. April 27th. Moving on up. 1963. Little Peggy March started a three-week run at number one in the U.S. singles charts with I Will Follow Him.
I will follow him wherever he may go.
So she was 15 at the time. Wow. 15 years, 1 month, and 13 days old. And Peggy March became the youngest female singer to have a U.S. number one record.
Really?
Yep.
I kind of feel like Rebecca Black could have beat that with the right management.
Well, I mean, I guess it's possible, but... I don't think Rebecca Black actually hit number one, did she?
No.
So, there you go. Not to mention her song sucks compared to I Will Follow Him.
You know what? You take that back.
Nope, not going to. Moving on up to 1974, a free afternoon event was held in a parking lot of University of Connecticut's Ice Hockey Arena in Storrs. The four acts that appeared were Aerosmith, mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
Fairport Convention and Fatback.
Never heard of them.
And then Springsteen went on to play another gig that evening at the University of Hartford in Connecticut.
Hardworking man.
That's kind of an incredible thing because I know his shows are huge mm-hmm. and they last forever. So
you know what? All of that was completely overshadowed because Ray Stevens released The Streak on the same day in 1974. No, oh, yes, they call him The Streak.
Thought it was 84.
No.
Oh, you did that in 74?
Yeah, the same year as the streaking craze.
There you go. Yeah. Crazy. So what I also know is that then later on, I don't think it was the same day. I think it was the next day. Aerosmith was sued for doing something along the lines of they were supposed to play a free concert, and then they kind of backed out because they were supposed to make up for a concert that had been canceled mm-hmm. and like all this stuff. And so basically they filed a class action lawsuit against the band to get their money back. And like also it was this huge to do, but it was just funny that like in the same week, it's like they played a free show and then supposed to play a free show and then got sued because they didn't. So weird, weird stuff. Let's see. So, Jake, what do you got next?
Oh, we got in 1976, David Bowie is detained in Poland.
Detained.
Yes, his bags and personal items are searched, And he's accused of being a Nazi and held for like 48 hours.
I remember this story.
Yes.
Yeah, he was like found with a bunch of Nazi stuff, like books and items.
Yes.
And he was like tried to explain to them that he was researching for a part, right?
Okay.
Like in a movie or something.
Okay, so for those who don't know, in much of Europe, any Nazi paraphernalia is completely banned.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the Nazi party itself has been banned. If you put together a meeting, you'll be arrested. If you publish books on Nazi ideals, you'll be arrested. If you own a Hitler Youth knife, you could be arrested for that.
Yeah.
So David Bowie came into Poland with a whole bunch of history books and the personal journal of Joseph Goebbels and a couple of other things. And he spent basically like almost 2 days talking to Polish intelligence officers saying that he was researching for a role and the documentary and a possible movie and some other things that he was working on.
Yeah.
And still to this day, I keep seeing people call like David Bowie a Nazi. And I never understood why until this story came up.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
I'm sure this is the origins of it.
Like, I mean, he's never really like had any other Nazi tendencies until
Right.
It's like one event where he was picked up with this stuff and everybody was like, oh, he's a Nazi. I mean, like, I wouldn't have even cared had it just been he, you know, was a collector of historical things. And so he wanted some stuff from, you know, the Nazis in World War II.
But it's a little weird to travel with it when you go to Moscow if you're just collecting things.
I mean, like, maybe it was just he happened to be on that path, but I mean, I don't really care either way.
Right.
I mean, like, if he was a Nazi, then of course I would care, but he wasn't a Nazi, so I don't. But
yeah, but come on, all that Nazi ideal that's buried in Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so apparent.
We all know that Ziggy Stardust is just an amalgam of Hitler and, you know, Goebbels, so.
If you rearrange the letters of Major Tom, you'll come up with Klaus Barbie, I don't know.
88, I don't know. 88 is like the only neo-Nazi like reference I get because
really?
It's the H is the eighth letter, so HH.
Oh, that's what I was thinking, the 88 anti-tank gun or the AA gun.
No, like which of course, you know, we being the players of close combat back in the day fully understand that when your tank comes around a corner and you see that 88 sitting there, you dead.
Yeah.
Unless you luckily get a shot off first or something. But yeah, the 88 was a nasty gun. We segued again into real history. How dare we? Is that all you got?
1981. You got anything before that?
No.
All right. 1981, Ringo Starr marries Barbara Bach.
Yeah.
After having met her on the set of the film Caveman.
Caveman with Dennis Quaid, right?
Yes. Yeah, with Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, because I remember it's mm-hmm. weird because, you know, Dennis Quaid back then in there, he was a very handsome man. And so it's like, there's Dennis Quaid with like Ringo Starr looking all caveman-esque. It's like, but Dennis Quaid looks like his typical self. It cracks me up.
My grandfather, that was his favorite movie, was that caveman movie.
Really?
Yes. Every Thanksgiving, he would sit down and watch that caveman movie.
Do you know what I watched for Thanksgiving?
No.
I watched The Road Warrior.
Okay. Odd choice.
I started watching it years ago because, you know, I was at home and I like had it on VHS. And so I was like, yeah, why not? I'll put it on. And so like to this day, I still want to watch Road. Even if I don't, I still want to watch Road Warrior for Thanksgiving.
Interesting.
Weird. I don't get it.
But still married.
Yeah.
Still married. And Barbara Bell is in, like, my favorite Italian Nouveau spy movie,
which is
called The Black Belly of the Tarantula.
The Black Belly of the Tarantula.
It's
this
really weird movie where it's her and two other Bond girls.
Yeah, because she was a Bond girl.
Yes. And they're all secret agents, and it's this weird, like, the spider's web of deceit and lies. And the tagline for the movie was a gothic tale of terror and death.
A gothic tale of terror and death.
Because it's got, you know, like the weird like 80s sound effects from, you know, Italian films.
Yes.
Yeah. It's so bizarre.
You can always tell when those random movies are made in Italy because it's just no place looks like Italy.
Right, right. So. And the voiceovers don't match. The voices don't match up because they didn't record sound. They didn't
Oh, man.
They were doing that up to the mid-90s, but anyway.
Let's see. Moving on to 1984, I got another one for you, Jake, that you won't care about.
Okay.
Born on this day, Patrick Stump, lead singer, rhythm guitarist for Fall Out Boy.
Ah, okay. Well.
No, you're not a big Fall Out Boy fan?
Not really. Some people are really taken by them.
For me, like, Fall Out Boy, I enjoy listening to their music sometimes. But like Sugar We're Going Down is like the best song that they wrote. So
I can't stand the vocals on the studio recording original of that. I've heard them like recordings of them do it live and his vocals are clearer, but he mumbles so much.
Yeah, he does mumble a lot. I had to look up the lyrics.
Yes.
Because he mumbled way too much, but I loved the music to it, and the video was goofy too. So that's one. I don't know. I actually enjoy it. I've seen a Fall Out Boy live, and I mean I was fairly uninterested in them, but Sugar We're Going Down, like that's my jam. Love that one. But I think you're closing out April 27th.
Here we go, 2002.
Jumping ahead
on this day in history, April 27th, 2002. For the first time since 1963, the U.S. Hot 100 contains zero British acts.
Wow. Really?
Yes.
That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
And, well, the website that I got this from accused the U.S. of being fools and completely ignoring Blur, who released a really great album.
I could see that.
I disagree because Blur, biggest hit in the U.S., song 2, sounds nothing like any of the rest of their work.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
Because I bought that album based on that song and was thoroughly disappointed.
That was the middle. Like, the U.S. has enjoyed several British invasions.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, it happened in the 60s, not so much in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Happened in the 80s, and a couple of British acts made it into the 90s. But then in the 2000s, like, nothing happened I mean, like, nothing. I can't recall one British band. I mean, there was a couple of Australian groups, but I can't recall one British band that was really big in, like, the early 2000s or even later 2000s.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, that completely changed, where, like, a group of, let's see, I don't even remember who it started with. I remember Lily Allen, and then I remember, the one girl who had the beehive hairdo, and she died of a drug overdose.
Oh, Amy Winehouse.
Amy Winehouse. Yeah. I remember she showed up and then like
trying to make me go to rehab and I said no, no, no.
Would have done her good. But that's beside the point. but then like, you know, coming around on the edges of that one, you then had like Adele.
Right.
With her first album. And then like the next group of them started showing up. That's where, you know, like Ed Sheeran started showing up, and just one thing after another. And now we've got like another massive influx of British acts that, of course, have dominated Grammy Awards and all that kind of fun stuff. So this is the next wave of the British invasion, and I think we're kind of we're coming up to the end of it, I think. I honestly believe that. I think that in the next couple of years, like, you know, the same people that are big right now, they're still going to be big, but we're not going to have a lot of new British acts. I think we're coming down off the wave now. That's my prediction.
There could be completely a 12-year-old in Liverpool right now that's just drumming away.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, you've got like the 1975, and they're doing great stuff right now. So, but moving on to our last day, April 28th. Jake, you got something for me.
Oh, yes. Here we go. 1958, David Seville's The Witch Doctor hits number one. You're familiar with that song, aren't you?
Isn't it? Ooh-ee, ooh-ah-ah, ding-dang, walla-walla-bang-dang.
Yeah.
Ooh-ee, ooh-ah-ah, ding-dang,
walla-walla-bang.
I told the Witch Doctor, he told me what to do.
You said that? Yeah. But that was the first song that he recorded, and I could be mistaken, but I think it's the first song that hit number one that had sped up vocals.
I can
because
see
he recorded it at normals.
Yeah.
He recorded normal, then sped up the vocals. Anyway, David Seville, if you didn't know, was the stage name for the guy who created the Chipmunks.
Yeah.
And the Chipmunks manager's name is David Seville.
Huh.
So there you go.
Well, I mean, he didn't make the Chipmunks.
Well, he's the creator of them. I mean, I don't think he was the original animator, but he wrote the music for them.
No, I got to look this one up.
Go
I'm sorry,
for it, buddy.
Okay, all right. Because let's see.
Mm-hmm. Eli
Chipmunks.
Created by Roethlisberger and
Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Work, let's see. Simply, the Chipmunks, an American animated music group created by Ross Bagdasarian Sr. And I'm not seeing your dude listed there.
So click on Ross.
Members.
Go ahead and click on Ross.
Members of Alvin and the Chipmunks, mm-hmm. right? Alvin Seville, Simon Seville, Theodore Seville. You want me to click on Ross Bagdasarian?
Yeah, go ahead and click on
an Armenian.
If you say so.
He is an Armenian.
Okay.
He's a famous Armenian. Everybody knows. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Any name, that, generally, any name ending in Y-A-N or I-A-N is Armenian.
Okay.
So, and there, but trust me, this dude is Armenian. I can even tell you from the picture.
Yeah, that's the guy. He's the dude that sang Witch Doctor.
Oh, is he?
Yes.
All right.
There you go. I tied it into your headline and first story and didn't even know it. Boom, dropping the mic.
Let's see here.
This is terrible audio.
Is it? Wait. Oh, you. Wait. Okay. Yep. Uh-huh. All right. I got it. You did it. You got it right.
Okay.
David Seville was a stage name.
Thank you. Take it away.
There you go. That's kind of goofy, actually. But yeah.
Well, when your name can't even be printed on an LP, David Seville it is.
Bagdasarian.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching an Armenian today. Manchester United.
Ah, yes.
They got themselves a fine Armenian on their one, so on their team. So that was. We actually watch quite a bit of soccer right now. That was me. I hit the desk. If you were wondering what that noise was, we actually watch a lot of soccer at the office. So a lot of sports in general. But whenever soccer's on, I actually pay attention, as opposed to the tons of baseball that everybody else watches, mm-hmm. and I'm bored to death. But yeah, that's.
You're not looking at the game within the game, Brian.
Oh, I am. I've just seen enough baseball to not care.
So. Well, then. I don't know what to tell you.
I will go to
other
a game.
Other than on this day in 1987.
You can do that. I'm just going to say I'll go to a game and I'll watch it and I'll enjoy myself. Yeah. But at the same time, watching baseball on TV does nothing for me. Not like watching hockey.
Well, I love baseball.
Let's go Blues.
And go Cards. Anyway, 1987, the very first album, which was primary release, was on compact disc and not on vinyl, was released. It was Tony Bennett's The Art of Excellence.
Oh, wow. That's cool. You jumped ahead of me, though.
Well, all right. Somebody had to get the reins back on the horse.
Yeah, you started talking about the Armenians, so, Alvin and the Chipmunks.
You're right. I should have foreseen that.
So, no, in 1982, the California State Assembly Consumer Protection Committee heard testimony from experts,
mm-hmm.
I did air quotes, yes, who claimed that when Stairway to Heaven was played backwards, contained the words, "I sing because I live with Satan, the Lord turns me off, there's no escaping it, here's to my sweet Satan,
yes.
whose power is Satan. He will give you 666. I live for Satan."
Whose Power is Satan? My absolute favorite all-time love song. Golden Oldie, love to dance to it. Whose power is Satan?
I think that's Satan.
Yeah.
Jake, I know it's a weird thing, but that is actually one of my favorite things that you ever said to me, and I still remember it to this day, and you probably don't even know what I'm talking about.
It's Satan.
Is that?
I think.
Is that, yeah, you, there's a bumper sticker on the back of that red truck that you used to have, and it said something, I forgot what it actually said, but it had Satan in it, and like my brother said something, Satan.
Satan's a nerd.
Satan's a nerd. And then you said, I think it's Satan. And it... That stuck with me. I don't know why it did, but that stuck with me this day.
There was a hockey player named Satani
played
for the Quebec Nordiques.
Yes, I know. We've talked about him, not on this show, but on one of the Blues, NHL podcast. We have two Canadians that play, and so they've mentioned Satan and they've mentioned Guy Lafleur. So they met him a couple of times, as far as I know.
Lafleur.
It's cool. Yeah. Let's move on up to 1990. Guns N' Roses leader Axl Rose married Erin Everly, daughter of the Everly brothers, Don, at Cupid's Wedding Chapel in Las Vegas. I've seen Cupid's Wedding Chapel, actually.
Have you now?
Yeah, it's pretty small.
Like this big? Like it's, you can fit like a cot and a toothpick in it?
No, it's like a wedding chapel. It's a small little wedding chapel. Okay. And those things really are like all over the place, especially in the old part of Vegas. Usually right next to like a place where you can get your marriage annulled, which is really funny to me. They divorced January 1991 after a stormy 9 months of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Those poor kids. But c'est la vie. Guns N' Roses, who cares?
I guess.
Actually, that's not true. Guns N' Roses is coming to town, and I am tempted to see them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'd probably be a pretty decent show. Although I'm not too big on Axl Rose. I mean, I really like Slash's guitar playing, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what do you got for me? You got something.
That's going to be, like, the slowest riot. The whole crowd.
Everyone's kind of wondering what's going to happen.
On walkers. Hey, actually, I work with a guy who was a bouncer.
Yeah.
Well, excuse me, not a bouncer. A security guard at that show.
Oh, wow.
So, there you go. Wow, amazing story. Thanks, Jake.
The only time I've ever, like, seen anything close to, like, people getting really pissed off after a concert was when Kings of Leon, when they played in St. Louis, because I was at that show.
So, oh, well.
But they came back. They played a free show.
They did.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
And they've been back ever since. And actually, I thought it was really cool what they did, because when they came back and they played, the lead singer of Kings of Leon, Caleb, actually then said, you know, hey, it's like, I was actually kind of terrified to come out here tonight. It's like, but you guys are really cool. It's like, and you've made us feel like, you know, we are welcome here.
Yeah.
So, and I was happy with that. They, you know, those dudes are actually pretty cool. I've had a chance to meet them, and I got them to laugh at least when I walked up to them. I said, hey, I'm a huge fan. And Caleb was like, yes, you are. So, but that's my little side story. What else you got?
April 28th, 2000, some jackass burns down the office of the Godfather of Soul.
Yes, I heard about that.
Yeah. So James Brown had an office where his business was kept and...
His business.
And a lot of, like, the original recordings or very early presses or, like, the vinyl masters that you print, you know, vinyls off of.
That everything else comes off of, yeah.
Yeah, they were all lost in that. And it was a former employee of his whose name I didn't bother to write down because he's a jackass.
There you go.
So there you go. And he spent some time, and I think he's since been released from prison on arson.
Wow.
So hope it was worth it.
Yeah. Anyway. That's ridiculous. I can't stand people who destroy history, so.
Yeah.
I can't. I mean, like, to me, that's almost an unforgivable crime, so. What?
No, nothing. I was thinking of, you know, the Ten Commandments as a la Brian Croc, you know.
Well, no, I mean, like, I've seen these things of where, I mean, like, I know he didn't exactly mean to do that. It's just that it was a byproduct of the violence or whatever that he wanted to perpetrate. But at the same time, I've seen, like, things of, you know, ISIS, like, destroying, you know, 2,000-year-old Roman ruins, you know, that are there. It's like, just because. Like, oh, well, this has nothing to do with our religion, so to blow it up. Like, that to me is just insane. That is pure insanity. And that kind of stuff needs to stop. We need to preserve our history. But, you know, when people don't care about it, that just irks me to no end. And when they deliberately set out to destroy it, that's when it's unforgivable to me. So.
Oh, there you go.
I love my history. What can I say?
And speaking of history, 2003, this day, iTunes.
Like, it launched?
Yeah.
Wow. That's kind of amazing, actually. Yeah. Speaking of iTunes, you can find our show on iTunes. It's always good. If you happen to find our show on iTunes, find us on Facebook and Twitter as well and tell us that you found us on iTunes. And if you liked the show and you've listened so far, I'm sorry. But if you liked the show, please give us a review and a like. It's always good. And I will appreciate it thoroughly. I may thank you by saying your name next time we record a show.
So, yeah, they had announced previously that they were going to do this thing called iTunes, and they were going to sell music and have this market and blah, 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 blah. And you'll remember, we talked about this before, that Apple Corps had an agreement with Apple Computers.
Yeah.
And that Apple Computers could continue to use the Apple logo so long as they never sold music.
Yeah.
And then they announced that they were going to do it, so Apple Corps immediately sued them before they even had a chance to start selling music to break the contract.
Yeah.
But they ended up coming to an agreement. So this would have happened earlier, but the timetable got moved because they had to do what they had to do.
I remember when iTunes came out, a lot of people were just like, why?
Right.
It's like, I can download all this stuff on LimeWire. You remember LimeWire?
Oh, jeez.
Back in the day. So, yeah, people, and Napster, even. Like, but Napster had switched.
Sirius?
Yeah, but Napster had switched over to a purchase program as well.
Yeah.
And then iTunes came along. But the reason why iTunes then started becoming huge was because of the creation of MP3 players.
Right, right, right.
And so you had the iPod, which was then in association with iTunes, and like that's how people started buying more music and like blah blah blah, and so that's just how it exploded into what it is today. I still to this day don't really use iTunes. Like, I use Amazon yeah. Music or something along those lines, but back in the day even I didn't use it. I used mp3.com
yeah,
because you could get like credits and then you could download albums based off of those credits. It was kind of like a monthly service, so.
I used to really like iTunes as just a piece of software.
Yeah.
And they keep making it more and more difficult to actually work with. Like, if you want to create a playlist, it's like you have to fool the genius to, like, pick the things you might, the things you might want. You can't, like, it's so difficult to just, like, hey, put this song in this playlist.
Yeah.
And I, oh, boy, that just, I can't stand it. Anyway.
Yeah,
I looked up the press release that Steve Jobs did, you know, like his keynote speech or whatever. And previously, Apple Corps had said it would be a cold day in hell when they relinquished their claim to music on the contract. So the words behind him was a cold day. It's a cold day in hell.
Yeah, but they didn't put the Beatles on there for a long time.
Yes, yes.
Because I remember when that actually happened. But yeah, they... because it was like this huge deal, the Beatles on iTunes.
Yeah.
But man, that's just kind of crazy though to think that it's been that long since iTunes was actually created.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
weird.
I just wish that they would keep features that they had previously whenever they add new ones. Like, I get that iTunes is great if you're a 6-year-old and you just need like 2 buttons to push to do something.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Or if you're an octogenarian. And, you know, it's great. But, like, look, I've been using iTunes for, like, 12 years. I think I should be able to use it the same way I've been using it for 12 years.
You know what I loved, though? And I saw this recently. Somebody had downloaded the latest version of Winamp. You remember Winamp?
Yes. It really whips still, the llama's ass.
Still looks exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Is it back up? Because for a while, their servers were down.
As far as I know. Like,
you couldn't download the program anymore.
Well,
it was like a year ago.
All I know is that dude had it up, and yeah. It was like, well, there's Winamp. It's like, looks exactly the same. Like, good Lord. But,
anyway.
Jake, I think we have come to an end.
Ba-ba-boosh.
We've come to the end for April 28th, and that covers the week for this week in music history. And I think we had a good one. I think it was a fun show. This was nice. We had a lot of weird tangents, but
yes,
you know.
We always do.
We always do. But if you enjoyed the program, obviously you can help us out by going to our website or giving us a like or a follow on Facebook and Twitter. Or if you want, you can go to the website, click on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side, and buy some stuff, and then help us out that way. That's always a good thing to do for us, because it doesn't cost you anything extra. It's just nice, easy money for us to make. But I am Brian Kroc. Along with me has been Jacob Crum.
Good evening, good night, and goodbye.
And this has been Follow the Sound. Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.